Johnson. I'm the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and FME Ineffable. This week's podcast is once again an episode about mindfulness that I'm going to send to Reka. This is a discussion of people of color within the mindfulness movement, many other interesting topics for people interested in bringing mindfulness into their lives. Thanks for listening to Multifaithful, and how to Reka leading this week's conversation.
So I want to welcome Lama Rod Owens with us today here at Mindful NYU. He participated in our panel discussion, Buddhism Now, that happened on April 5th here in our offices at Grand Hall. So I want to thank him for joining us today. Lama Rod is an activist, organizer, essayist, poet, and authorized Dharma teacher in the Tibetan Tantric tradition of Buddhism. He is a core teacher with Natural Dharma Fellowship in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a second-year Master of Divinity student at Harvard Divinity School, where he studies the intersection of Buddhism and social change. He has appeared in the Buddhist publications Lion Roar and Buddha Dharma, and has been recognized as one of the emerging leaders of the next generation of Dharma teachers. He is also a co-author of Radical Dharma, due out in June 2016 from North Atlantic Books, which explores race and oppression within American Buddhist communities. Thank you so much for joining us today. So I thought we'd just start out by you letting our listeners know a bit about you, you know, your background, how you came to the practice, and how you came to be a teacher.
Okay. Yeah, wonderful. Thank you for having me. And so now I've been thinking a lot about, you know, my story, as I am always, well, these days ask often to kind of recount how I've ended up in, you know, certain positions that I find myself in now. I really have to go back to being born and raised in the South, in Georgia, being in a context that felt very alien to me. In the Bible Belt, Deep South, you know, I grew up Christian in the church. When I was about 12, my mother became a minister, a local pastor in the Methodist church. So I became a preacher's kid at the age of 12. And of course, that brought with it certain responsibilities. One of which was to actually go to church and and to kind of represent my mother, you know, in certain spaces. And I remember my mother telling me, "Oh, you know, I'm a preacher now. I'm a minister now. That means that people look at you as a representative of my ministry." And I really took that to heart. What she was doing, looking back, was actually preparing me for my own ministry. But as I got older, as I moved into my teenage years, I began to really get really interested in radical movements, especially Black Power movements. The Black Panthers were like my idols. I also started to study the Haitian Revolution as an example of what Black liberatory organizing could look like. And so those two kind of things really deeply influenced me. I became really active in community service, and I ended up graduating high school, going to college, where I continued community service and deepened, you know, my questioning of why there were certain systems in place that prevented me from being happy and feeling whole and accepted and seen. So I really struggled emotionally, mentally, in undergrad. My undergraduate institution was really very white supremacist, very queerphobic, very heteronormative. And these are words and terms that I had no idea of as a student, but these are the experiences in which I was actively organizing against, you know. And so once I graduated undergrad, I actually moved to Boston from Georgia, where I joined a Catholic worker movement, a Catholic worker house. And there, my interest in anarchism and radicalism really commingled and integrated. And on top of that, this idea of that one can be spiritual and still be radical and anarchist.
Mm.
You know, one can be loving and compassionate, but still challenge the systems that create violence and oppression. And that really changed the course of my life. And that's in that community I met Dharma. You know, but before meeting Dharma, I really had to work through severe depression, severe clinical depression, which was really eating me alive, you know, until I was taught to meditate. I started working with a local healer. We started meditating together. We started doing energy work together, revamping my nutrition, getting me to exercise, changing the friends I hung out with, limiting violence that I was consuming, absorbing from the environment and from media. And all that really helped me to emerge out of the illness, you know, and I emerged as someone really interested in what else I could do with the mind and with meditation. So I continued my meditation practice and was very fortunate to be living with community mates who were engaged in Dharma practice. And so I started hanging out with them in their practice spaces and really discovered that Buddhism was where it was at for me. And early on, I developed the aspiration to become a Dharma teacher before any formal commitment to practice happened. So essentially, I told people, yes, I want to commit to Dharma and Buddhism for the rest of my life, you know, and I know eventually I'll probably find a teacher and a sangha and all this other stuff.
That way. Okay.
So like finding the teachers and the practices were very secondary. Like I knew that this was it and you didn't have to sell me anymore. And so I, you know, Tibetan Buddhism was the practice that I was practicing. That was the practice all of my friends were involved in, and it fit me perfectly. I went into our traditional 3-year retreat program and graduated in 2011. So I started in 2008, graduated in 2011, you know, and was authorized as a Lama. I ran my own center down in D.C. for about 2.5 years. Before deciding to return to graduate school at Harvard Divinity School to study Buddhism. But as I was emerging back into graduate school, that radicalization started happening again around incidents in Ferguson and Michael Brown. Not only that, it was the Israeli attacks in Palestine, you know, that were in the same summer. And so I was really, Palestine, Israel were really issues that I care about, as well as the lives of Black people. And I kept seeing the assault of Black life, no matter where I went. And it was an assault against my life, you know, and I wanted to do something more again, you know, just as I felt as a, you know, a 15, 16 year old studying the Panthers or the Black, or the Haitian Revolution, I wanted to do something to counter, you know, the violence that I felt like I was experiencing. You know, so I, you know, deepened my practice. My practice had been deepening, but I came into organizing again from a place of loving, a place of holding my own woundedness, and then understanding that we are all wounded. You know, both the oppressed and the oppressor.
Can you speak more on that? What it is to hold those feelings and also want change at the same time. I know for a lot of people, they sort of say that activism is counterintuitive to Buddhism, which, you know, it's a strange way to look at it, but it is a way people look at it.
Well, it was really interesting because the Buddha was an activist. You know, what did the Buddha do when he attained enlightenment? He created essentially a cult which transcended cultural norms and class stratification, you know. And of course, there were other things that we may not fully understand, especially around gender, you know, and around the ways that he created different systems for monks and nons,
right.
You know, and that takes a lot of close examination. But overall, the Buddha, I think his intention was to counter the violence of stratification
mm-hmm.
within the community around him. So that was an extremely strong act,
mm-hmm.
you know, of activism. So holding the space, I think we have to, as activists and organizers, we have to be very real about the fact that we're hurting,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I think there's an extra layer of violence that happens when we're resisting feeling our own woundedness, experiencing
mm-hmm.
our own woundedness and our hurt. You know, I see a lot of activists and organizers in the community who are responding to their hurt instead of holding space for it,
mm-hmm.
you know, because responding to our woundedness actually triggers more violence.
Talk about that. What does that look like? What have you seen?
So I've seen people, black activists, during protests or demonstrations lose it.
Mm.
You know, especially in interacting with white folks.
Mm.
You know. I keep seeing that more and more. I begin to see more burnout. I know of someone who recently relocated, who left the country, a Black Lives Matter activist
wow.
that I knew of locally, who was like, I can't take this anymore, and left.
Mm.
You know?
And so when we're, what is the solution there? And what does holding our own space for our own pain and woundedness look like?
Mm-hmm.
How do we actually do that
mm-hmm.
when it feels like it's too much?
Mm-hmm. And I think that, first of all, we allow ourselves to feel that, and I think that we find support within community
mm-hmm.
to support us
mm-hmm.
in doing that. So I have a practice to hold my own woundedness
mm-hmm.
by myself,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I prefer to do it within community. A lot of people can't do the work by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I've been such an advocate for healing circles and healing spaces,
mm-hmm.
especially POC healing circles, where
mm-hmm.
we're able to gather together and we help each other hold the pain. We help each other cry through. We help each other rage through,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we help each other experience that racial trauma within our bodies. And we develop this intimacy with it, and we're able to say, okay, this has happened to me, and this is my experience, you know, and now I can actually start letting it go because there's a space around it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not so lost in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what many of us are experiencing, this sense of being lost in our trauma. You know, once we begin to pay attention to it, begin to develop a dialogue with it, then you'll see a space opening up because you begin to step back from it.
Right.
Because we begin to understand that I am not this trauma. This is just something that it has happened to me,
mm-hmm.
that I am actually in many ways contributing to the reality of this in my body
mm-hmm.
because I have not yet learned the ways to release this trauma from my experience. And nor have I learned a way to continually interrogate the trauma that I'm taking in, you know, and experiencing and letting it go, you know. So I think for many healers, including myself, we've developed this practice of being in the world
mm-hmm.
and learning how to let go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a lot of, like, negative interactions, a lot of microaggressions. You know, I'm able to let it go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of that has to do with my own Dharma practice,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially around loving kindness, compassion, but even more around these teachings around emptiness.
Mm.
You know, it's like, what's really happening? You know, how is my ego getting involved in wanting this to be something that it can differentiate itself, you
mm.
know, to make it feel special?
Mm.
You know,
mm.
How can I let go of this idea of wanting to be separate?
Mm.
How can I see the illusion of everything that's arising, you know? And a good example of that, I remember after my very first 10-day intensive retreat, which was about 13 years ago, I was away and I came back from the retreat and had this interaction where someone called me, you know, a really hurtful name, you know, it was the N-word, you know, which I don't use, you know. And I remember being destroyed, like the high that I was on after retreat, I just completely crashed. And a lot of fear came up, you know, and it was very scary, you know, because I thought I was enlightened after the first retreat.
After first retreat, yeah.
You know, and I was like, oh, I have all this work to do. And so I made a vow to really engage, you know, in doing that. And I remember right after my 3-year retreat, you know, having a similar experience and being really confused, you know, someone calling me the exact same thing. And I was just really sitting there going, who are they talking about? You know, and I was so shocked. That was my gut reaction. I was like, I don't know what that means anymore. You know, because what had happened is I let go of all of that meaning around language. You know, it's like, you can call me that, but, like, that's not exactly who I am. And what Dharma has taught me is that, essentially, I am this Buddha. I have this pure enlightened nature. You know, if you're calling me that name, then you have no idea who I am. Because you don't know who you are. You know, so the violence that I experience, often in forms of microaggressions, are really expressions of other people's pain. You know, so if you have that understanding, it makes it better and that creates more patience, you know. So I'm able to say, okay, yeah, I hear that. I see what's happening and I can stay in this space, but like, I'm also going to say there are boundaries.
Yeah.
You know, so it doesn't mean that like, I'm just like willingly staying in certain spaces and taking this in. No, what I'm really saying is that I become very clear about what my boundaries are and what my limits are to my practice. I'm able to say, you know, I can't be in this space when it's too much. And that keeps me from going over the line into hate.
Yeah.
You know, and I take care of myself like that by refraining.
So along those lines, you know, many of our listeners are young people.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for many of them, it's scary to touch into your vulnerability, to touch into those places. I wonder what sort of beginner advice you could sort of give to those who are even too scared to go there. Part of this, what you're saying is really sitting with your pain, right? But that can be really scary, especially when so much is happening in a young person's life as it is. So, yeah, can you give a little advice to our listeners about the start of that? What does that look like in the beginning?
I think in the beginning, I would really encourage for people to have allies in the work, you know, and that's not a lot of people, but really it's important for you, for anyone to identify one or two people that you feel safe with or around, to start opening up to start communicating some of this really deep, deep, heavy stuff.
Yeah. You know? And I'm curious about that, you know. We'll probably talk a bit about it in other ways, but social media is a huge part of their lives in a way that it wasn't for me when I was younger. And so community and allies, it feels like it's the nature of that is changing in some ways. And social media can be their friends, but it can also really be, in a lot of ways, their foes. So when we talk about community, finding allies, is that with technology, apart from technology, what is the difference between in-person versus virtual? Can you speak to some of that stuff too?
I think, well, for me, I think about my growing up. I mean, it wasn't until I started college that I knew what the internet was to begin with. Like, it was my senior year in high school was the first time I ever heard of people getting an email address. And we were just like, well, this is really fancy. Who's going to ever be into that? And, you know, and look what happened, you know. So I started college really exploring, I think, like a lot of other people, this idea of how do you build communities online in these early initial stages of the internet. And I got a lot of benefits out of that, and that helped me to understand that, like, I, you know what, I don't maybe need to see someone in person, and maybe I don't need to know you in life, but like I think it's really beneficial for me to be able to chat with someone who just listens and maybe like responds with, yeah, I hear you. You know, I've been there before. You know, that sucks. You know? And I had many friends throughout those beginning years who I never met, never saw a picture of, because that was still really new.
Yeah. Like AOL or
it was
something.
AOL.
Like that. Yeah, yeah.
You just had text and a green or blue screen, you know, and that was it, you know. And that was how I got through feeling isolated. So I didn't know a lot of other queer people, you know. I didn't know a lot of other radical people of color. But I met them online. And, you know, we shared our lives together, you know. And then I was able to start building relationships to people, you know, in person. So I encourage young people, and I work with young people as well. And I'm friends with them on Facebook and social media. I see how they're interacting online, and it's critical for them, you know, to have these interactions online. You know, and I understand that, you know.
And so what do you feel like, so the online community is a great way to sort of step into it, find space when you feel isolated. Do you feel like there's a part of the practice or a part of the benefit to be in person with the community as well?
You know, social media, on the other hand, is really robbing us, our creating obstacles for how we're able to relate to people in person. You know, and I see that when we're with our friends and everyone's texting.
Yeah.
You know, or on Facebook, and that's just acceptable. You know, it's acceptable to be hanging out, texting someone else, you know, as well. And so yeah, I think that we should, when we can, develop personal one-on-one relationships with people around us, you know. And I think if young people are, and you may be in the high school, you know, seeking out the guidance counselor, or, you know, or like your favorite teacher, you know, someone that, you know, you feel close to, or maybe there's someone in your family, you know, but that's not always the case. You know, in colleges, you know, there's the chaplain's office, there's the school counselors, and again, you know, you should develop a relationship online, then like maybe we can, you know, bring that relationship, you know, offline in person, you know. And there are ways to do that. So definitely one-on-one interactions, live interactions are still really key, you know. So we're doing essentially what we can with what we have. You know.
And how are you seeing that show up in your Sangha, in your community? What are you seeing as being sort of like the need around interconnectedness and community? What issues are you seeing are most prominent for people these days, young people or otherwise, that are showing itself? What are bringing people to the Dharma, to the practice, to mindfulness practices? And we'll talk about that in a second, in general.
Well, I think people really understanding how difficult life can be. And for many young people, including myself, we really discovered that the traditional church structure wasn't getting at the core issues. You know, for me, it was primarily this idea of sexuality and gender. It wasn't enough space for me to be in church. You know, I didn't see myself reflected, nor was I talked about my life. Wasn't articulated. So I think people look at Dharma Sanghas, you know, and meditation groups as much more open, much more progressive, sometimes radical, allowing it to, with there being enough space for people of different kinds of differences to be represented. You know, in theory, that's what we think, but so often we find ourselves in communities that are constricting in other ways, you know. And so I think that we are struggling to understand difference right now in our communities, mm-hmm. and people are hungry to have authentic interactions, you know, to actually interrogate the ways in which power has created these dynamics
mm-hmm.
within our organizations and groups,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to be vulnerable about that. Also understanding that our identities have been built around power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for those of us who have different kinds of power, for those of us who don't have those kinds of power,
mm-hmm.
you know, wanting to be very vulnerable about that, but needing support to go through the pain and how we're learning to identify beyond power and structure, but to identify with this basic sense of there's a commonality there,
mm-hmm.
but that commonality has to be earned,
mm-hmm.
you know, through examining difference,
mm-hmm.
and through going through the ways in which we've contributed consciously and our unconsciously to this kind of violence
mm-hmm.
around difference
yeah.
that we've created.
And so that's a lot of what's coming up in the practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, in your own role as a
mm-hmm.
as a lama,
mm-hmm.
you know, we've touched upon this a little bit, there is hierarchy there, right?
Yeah.
There is
yeah.
separation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to talk about a couple of things. One, how you sort of navigate that,
mm-hmm.
Given what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
And also, what is it to be a teacher in these practices these days? And then we'll move a little bit into sort of the mindfulness, secular
mm-hmm.
kind of perspective of,
mm-hmm.
of these practices.
Mm-hmm.
But let's start with
mm-hmm.
how you navigate your own
mm-hmm.
position.
Right. Well, I'm really transparent around ethics.
Okay.
And so on my website, lamarad.com, I have a really detailed kind of treatment of what I understand ethics to be and what I understand my role to be and what I understand the role of students or mentees that study with me
mm-hmm.
to be and how we're protected, you know, in our roles. That's the way I interrogate power. You know, I want to be very clear about what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Transparency.
It's very transparent.
Yeah.
You know, so I've had situations where, you know, I may be romantically involved with someone,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then they may express interest to study with me, and
mm-hmm.
that changes the relationship.
Yeah.
And it's very drastic.
Yeah.
And people say, well, you know, Rod, I think that's really, you know, kind of drastic,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you pull out the ethics statement and say, you can't have both.
Mm-hmm.
I'm either your mentor or your lover.
Right.
You know? Because if we mix the two, then right now in my practice, I can't guarantee that that won't be a kind of psychic violence.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
So many teachers won't say that publicly.
Mm.
You know, but I have to say that publicly because that's the kind of life that I live.
Yeah.
You know, I talk a lot about authenticity.
Mm.
Authenticity means that I'm being true to my own desire, my own passion, and being transparent
mm.
about that in private and on the cushion.
Mm.
So I'm bridging both of those worlds together. And what you get is the same person you get at the club and at the bar.
Mm.
You know, it's the same person that shows up on the cushion.
Mm.
You know, this is the same person that's sitting here right now.
Mm.
You know, so I am trying not to have these different personas. Like, this Dharma persona is just who I am.
Mm.
You know, as a teacher, as a lama, I want to challenge this tradition of lamas having so much power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's important for there to be space. There just should be some distance, you know, in a relationship. But that distance or the space between myself as the teacher and others as the student shouldn't be filled with this kind of like expectation.
Mm-hmm.
From this expectation that the student is expected to feel. You know, so another way of saying that is that I don't enter into relationships wanting anything.
I see.
From students. I want students to practice and I want students to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't need you, you know, to fulfill my longing and my craving or like my need, you know, sexual or other. You know, I don't use students.
And you felt that that's been the case in other situations?
Oh, I think it's rampant.
Yeah.
And among Dharma teachers, it may not be as drastic as sexual abuse, but many teachers are very, they're not clear about their role. They're very ambivalent, you know. And when that happens, all these kind of ethical things start, unethical things start to happen, you know.
Yeah.
And then that begins to hurt the students.
So, along those lines then, you know, what makes a teacher, right? Like these days, we've sort of seen a lot of people taking on teacher roles or sort of expertise in some ways, whether it's, you know, I'm a mindfulness expert or people who've come from, you know, monastic training and the Dharma, but then go into very secular worlds and practices. That's a lot to put in one question, but just wanted to sort of get your thoughts on that.
Well, I think of myself as a Buddhist minister. You know, and that was really important for me to shift into that framework because I get what a minister is. I grew up around ministers. And for me, a minister is someone who cares deeply about those that there are part of their congregation, their, you know, sangha, you know, their group. Ministers are people who model what the spiritual life should look like. You know, they're not perfect examples, you know, but they have studied and practiced enough to offer some guidance to others, you know, and you should take that really seriously.
Yeah.
You know, I take the role of being a minister very seriously. I know people are always watching me, you know.
Yeah.
At the same time, I'm going to do things that are fun in a really wise and intelligent way. You know, and understand that that's part of also mindfulness, you know. And so as a Dharma teacher, I think what we need, should be doing is thinking of ourselves more as ministers and trying to get other kinds of training that traditional ministers are having to get. You know, I'm very fortunate to be working towards a Master of Divinity with other students who are going for ordination in their denominations. So we're taking pastoral counseling classes, we're doing chaplaincy work, we're taking classes in other religions.
Yeah.
You know, we're having these conversations and these dialogues that help us actually understand how to take care of people because we're learning how to take care of ourselves. And ultimately, being a Dharma teacher is first and foremost taking care of ourselves. Because if we're not taken care of, then we expect our students to fulfill these needs.
Right.
It may not be appropriate for them to do. You know, being financially supported and something like that, I think that's okay. That's fine. That's important. But I think we have to be very clear about what else a teacher should be getting from students. You know?
Yeah.
And so I know people are getting expertise and a lot of training in certain areas, but I have to be very critical about that because when you say that you're a teacher, that's very heavy. And I don't think people are in it for that kind of heaviness. You know, they like it because it sounds good. It sounds like hot. You know, I'm a mindfulness teacher. Like a yoga teacher, and I'm not, you know, knocking any of that. That's important, but I think in the secular mindfulness world and within the Dharma world, we have to become very clear about language across both fields, you know.
Yeah.
So what is an instructor? What is a teacher? You know? And I think once we have some clarity, I think there will be less conflicts, you know, about roles.
Yeah. So the distinctions between those
distinctions, I know people go to do an eight-week mindfulness course and come out calling themselves a teacher.
Right.
Whereas there have been, I have known of people who have done decades of practice, you know, who don't even call themselves teachers.
Yeah.
You know, And that's part of our culture, right? Yeah. You know, it's like we want to have titles and
right.
we want to be special and different. But this is, we're talking about the minds
mm-hmm.
and we're talking about the quality of people's lives. And
mm-hmm.
we have to take that seriously. We're trustees
mm-hmm.
of that.
Yeah. So it's interesting to see because, I mean, there's this distinction between the generation before
yeah.
and, you know, Western, the sort of first round of Western
mm-hmm.
American
mm-hmm.
teachers
mm-hmm.
and sort of who's coming up now. It's
mm-hmm.
a very different world.
Right.
In many different ways between the previous generation and
mm-hmm.
ours and the ones who are coming after.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering what you see as the big distinctions there
mm-hmm.
Around who is a teacher these days.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, the first generation of drama teachers had to actually build the capacity for Dharma to be held
yeah.
in this context.
Mm-hmm.
So they did a lot of grunt work,
mm-hmm.
like literally physically building centers,
yeah.
Building Dharma centers, building monasteries. They were learning languages, you know, where there was no support for learning these languages. They were able to do that because that first generation of Dharma teachers were all a privilege.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of Dharma teachers had money, you know, they had this privilege where they could just like leave
mm-hmm.
and go to Asia,
mm-hmm.
you know, or go into retreat for years and years,
mm-hmm.
you know, they had a lot of support and that's great. Again, it's like, that's not bad,
yeah.
you know, and they've given a lot to us. So, but they weren't doing the work of integration
right.
because they couldn't. You know, you can't integrate something that isn't existing yet.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I think the new generation, the up-and-coming generation of Dharma teachers are presented with the challenge of integrating.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have enough Dharma centers built, we have enough monasteries built,
mm-hmm.
and now our role is about community building.
Mm-hmm.
It's about sustaining communities. It's about how do we integrate Dharma into these really deep-seated issues around identity
yeah.
and power and
mm-hmm.
class,
mm-hmm.
you know, because what that first generation did, again, they couldn't help it, you know, but they did, they created an exclusive Dharma,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it excluded many of us,
mm-hmm.
you know, from participating. And so we're trying to break that down and to interrogate that now
yeah.
and to become accessible.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think has been so critical, at least for us here at Mindful NYU, is very much bringing people to the dais
mm-hmm.
that will automatically, just by being there, bring
mm-hmm.
new people into our space.
Mm-hmm.
So that we have a lot of different kinds of welcoming,
mm-hmm.
you know, so our home looks like your home in many
mm-hmm.
ways, you know,
mm-hmm.
so I can see that difference in a lot of ways between different spaces that I've been in as a woman of color,
mm-hmm.
who where it didn't feel like my home.
Right.
Not only because of the people on the dais,
mm-hmm.
but also because of the people who were sitting with me
mm-hmm.
and how that has impeded my practice in
mm-hmm.
some ways, but it's been a lot of work to move beyond it
mm-hmm.
And still struggle for me
mm-hmm.
today. So
mm-hmm.
I hear what you're saying. Not that I'm not grateful
right.
for the Dharma in general,
yeah.
but yeah, it's
mm-hmm.
it's important for me to see somebody at least who somewhat represents
mm-hmm.
me on the dais.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And a lot of us, myself, I'll speak for myself, never had that opportunity.
Yeah. yeah.
You know, so I'm the first Black mama that I ever knew.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I thought like we were just like a unicorn
right.
or like the Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot. It's
yeah.
like I thought we would just have to send out a search party. You know, so I've met one other and there are others.
Right.
You know, we just, you know, I think what happens in my tradition is that we're systematically suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we don't know how to manage this really complicated hierarchy that Tibetan Buddhism presents.
Mm-hmm.
I think my strategy has been unknowingly was actually by kind of bypassing my own lineage
mm-hmm.
and getting exposure to other traditions
mm-hmm.
and being embraced by other traditions,
mm-hmm.
you know. And finally now I feel like I'm getting attention from my lineage.
Mm-hmm.
Now the like the insight and the Zen community,
mm-hmm.
you know, really appreciates me and
mm-hmm.
you know, invalidates me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I couldn't come up in that hierarchy because it was psychic violence for me as someone who's actively working against patriarchy and
mm-hmm.
the violence
mm-hmm.
of that. It just wasn't healthy
yeah.
for me. And I was getting pressure to conform
mm.
to this role. And it's really upsetting to be a part of a community that chooses not to recognize violence,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
in its own community. There's a lot of secrecy in Tibetan Buddhism,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I feel very conflicted often
mm-hmm.
about my role in exposing that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, so this idea of like, you know, when we as people of color walk into a sangha, you know, often my experience was being welcomed into the sangha, but also being just told to sit in the back and shut up.
Mm.
You know, that should actually just be grateful that in the door.
Mm.
And meanwhile, no one's talking to me or speaking my language.
Right.
And then you ask yourself, where are all the brown people? You know, because you don't talk to them. Like, metaphorically and, like, literally, you're not talking.
Yeah.
You know, to people who are different
mm-hmm.
than the rest of the sangha. And, like, how do we actually interrogate that and break through?
Yeah.
You know, how do we begin to speak the same language? You know, and one of the things is that we have to look at how our sanghas are dominated by these white, European, often very Puritan ideas, which are also integrated with the kind of like the intense patriarchy of the Asian mother countries
mm.
of practice,
mm.
you know, that come right in and complement what's already happening within the white community.
Mm.
You know, so you have this dual like power structure that's happening. You have the Asian teachers and you have the white teachers or the white sangha, and it can be very impossible to work with.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, a huge advocate of, you know, teachers starting their own sanghas, you know. And then, of course, going through the process of, like, integrating and, you know, having dialogue. But,
right.
like, for many of us, we can't survive, you know. And, of course, the irony for me is that I'm this teacher.
Right.
You know, and I'm often the only person of color in the room, you know.
Yeah,
and
from
I'm
the
holding,
other end of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm holding the teacher's seat. And what has happened over my teaching is that I don't care anymore. It's like, this is what's important to me. So if I end up, you know, in front of a white sangha, then, you know, chances are I'm talking about white privilege and white supremacy and practice.
Mm.
You know, I'm talking about power. Like, it doesn't matter, you know, because I actually don't fulfill my role when I don't represent what's important to me as a teacher, you know. And my role isn't to make people feel good,
right,
and to feel comfortable. A lot of teachers do that already, you know, so I don't have to do that,
right?
So my role is to disrupt and to create discomfort and to be messy,
which is life.
that's life, and
yeah.
that keeps us practicing.
Yeah.
You know, so many people are trying to roll into the sangha wanting to feel good and to be comfortable. And there are all kinds of sanghas and sitting groups that are doing that. And that's great. That's wonderful. There's a role for that, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm not a part of that.
Right.
That's something else that I can't get with.
Yeah.
But I can't judge that.
Right.
You know, but if you come to see me, if you come to sit with me, then you're asking for me to ask questions that you're avoiding.
Yeah. And the beautiful thing about the practice is that there are so many different ways to come into it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And finding the space for you is so critical. That's why it's so important for us to have people who represent what we need, welcome and being part of the teacher world.
It's that radical welcoming, you know. So not only are you're invited in, but you're asked, like, are you okay? Are you comfortable? You know, what should be different?
Yeah.
You know, what is your experience now? You know, like you're being paid attention to, you know, and you're being heard. And then the sangha changes. So a healthy Sangha is a Sangha that's willing to change, is willing to adopt,
mm-hmm.
well, to adopt different practices, and is also willing to adapt to the situation. You know, because that's what Buddha Dharma is, that's what Buddha Dharma does.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's innovating, you know, and we forget that. You know, because people who have the most power lose a lot when Dharma becomes innovative and adaptive, and when it begins to reflect difference, you know, it begins to reflect underrepresented folks, you know, and that's really scary if your whole identity is based on power and hierarchy. You know, so I get that.
Yeah.
You know, I get this is exactly what's happening in the country right now. Donald Trump is like, you have a whole lot of people, you know, who are realizing that there are a whole lot of people of color now.
Yeah.
You know, and that numbers are growing.
Yeah.
You know, and there's that fear.
Mm.
It's like people are beginning to see bit by bit, very slowly, that like this whole life that I've created and been taught to live is just like this big lie, and that it costs other people their dignity and their value and their self-esteem for me to have this life. That's a lot to start looking at and taking responsibility for.
Yeah.
So there's that compassion that arises for me. It's the same compassion that arises when I see white Dharma practitioners trying to come to terms with this.
Yeah.
You know, and I get that, and I have the space for it. And then we just, as a teacher, I hold the space for people, for myself and for others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I've been able to do the work, and I take that really seriously.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sometimes often really triggered by white people, you know, and I'm okay with saying that. I say that, you know, because that's part of racial trauma. Like, I've been deeply traumatized by white folks and their violence, their psychic violence against me, my spirit, my mind, you know, and I have to say that. It's not this thing that I'm blaming individuals for. I'm saying this is a cultural thing, this is a systematic thing, you know, that a lot of people are taking part in. You know, how can we hold the space for people of color to say that in the Sangha?
Yeah.
You know? Because it's one thing coming from me, but it's another thing coming from more than just me, but from others, you know. And I want to be an ally to other people of color who are trying to articulate that experience. It's easy for me to say, you know, like, that's my privilege.
Yeah.
Like, I don't back down. I'm not afraid. I say what's on my mind. Because I take this really seriously. If I'm not authentic to myself, and I let you down, and I think perhaps I create violence in certain ways for people, and that violence is like a force. It's something that goes against our will, you know. So when people of color aren't seeing me representing my particular intersectionality, then I let people down, and I think that increases the feeling of being marginalized. And silenced, you know. And there are teachers of color who don't go there.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really difficult for me to hear and to see.
So what is the hope then?
Yeah.
What is the hope sort of as you take on that authenticity as a teacher and hold that space and responsibility? What is then the hope without expectation, I suppose, that you sort of are looking for? How will the Sangha transform? What will the community look like that is ideal?
I think first and foremost, I think it's important for us to see teachers representing different lifestyles and occupying different bodies and different appetites. You know, we need to see different teachers doing different teachings, you know, and then that begins to challenge our understanding of what a teacher is supposed to look like. And then if we see teachers doing that, then people resonate, you know. So the more I can represent myself, the more other people of color feel empowered to be in the Sangha, you know, because they say, oh, I may be sitting here as a practitioner, as a student, but there's this person on the teacher's cushion that looks just like me, you know, who has a very similar lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that makes me feel good,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that trust piece is really important. Like, I want to earn the trust of everyone in the sangha,
yeah.
you know, especially people that I feel like I'm mirroring,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
where, you know, my intersectionality is matching theirs, you know, they need to see me up front.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a really difficult thing often for me. You know, I have a tendency to sit in the back
mm.
and to be silent, you know. But this, I've been an activist for too long, you know,
yeah.
where I know that's really not, you know, what I should be doing.
Mm.
So I moved to the front, you know, and I'm stepping more into a public position because you have to see me. You have to see that Dharma is different in this body,
mm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
That you can still have fun and do all these great things, you know, and still have a really deep and committed practice, you know. So that's my hope,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I hope to inspire other teachers of color and other queer teachers to come forward, or to inspire students to take the step into becoming teachers,
mm-hmm.
because they see me, you know, because I didn't see teachers of color.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see teachers of color until... really after I became a teacher,
yeah.
you know, and I want to be public and out and vocal for others. You know, I think the more of us that can do that, I think that's what can happen. You know, I think sangha and communities begin to shift,
yeah.
you know.
Well, I want to say that we're grateful that that is something that you're
mm-hmm.
seeking and hoping
mm-hmm.
to do. And represent, as you do for us. So we're grateful that you were part of our event. And thank you for your time today. I want to also encourage our listeners to look online for our event on our YouTube channel so you can hear more from Lama Rod and other panelists who have shared their infinite wisdom about these practices and the challenges we face in today's world. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. Especially like to thank Reka for being an awesome person to work with and for conducting the interview, and to Lama Rod for his time at NYU and for doing this interview as well. A special thank you also to Brian Young for editing and producing the podcast, and to Liz Matos, whose music is from the Ovmini film. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes. We look forward to having you back for another episode next week.